In the early 1960s, Mary Wells was the queen of Motown. She was the first Motown star with a number one hit, the first from the label to be nominated for a Grammy. And as this archival tape shows, she was even the Beatles' sweetheart.
Hey, ask any one of the Beatles who his favorite girl singer is, and he'll give you just one answer. She's the girl they recently invited to England to appear with him. The girl with a very much imitated vocal style. And here with her first million seller, My Guy, is Miss Mary Wells.
Life was not always so glamorous for Mary. She grew up in Detroit in the Black Bottom and Cass Corridor neighborhoods. At a young age, Mary was determined to find a way into the music industry. Peter Benjaminson is the author of Mary Wells, The Tumultuous Life of Motown's First Superstar, and he explained to Current State's Emmanuel Berry that Mary managed to get signed to Motown at age 16 by pestering Berry Gordy.
Please, give me an appointment so I come down and sing this song I wrote for you. Mr. Gordy. He kept ignoring her or saying, no, get out of here. What are you doing here? Get out. And finally, since she wouldn't leave, he got mad and said, all right. He stopped and said, sing it right now. So that's what she did. She just belted it out. He heard the song and then said, okay, all right, you got me. Come on down tomorrow with your mom, and we'll sign a contract, and you can record the song.
But so that was her first hit. Well, that was it. Bye Bye Baby. Is that?
Yes, yeah. It's great to listen to it because the original recording is still the one you can hear on YouTube, and her voice is very hoarse. Pop singers then and now don't open up their throats like opera singers do. But that wasn't really the reason that she was hoarse on Bye Bye Baby. The reason was because she'd had to stand there and sing it 22 times in a row with very few breaks, if any. That was because Motown had just a one-track system, which means that the backup singers, the backup musicians, Mary, the producer, the engineer, everybody had to do everything perfectly all at the same time. Because if one person made a mistake, Gordy was known for his high-quality recordings. If one person made a mistake, the whole thing
all
was ruined.
All over again.
So they had to go back to the beginning, yeah. At the end, you know, you could hear her voice rasping. But it fits in because she's supposed to be crying, you know, that this guy left her and sort of tearfully vowing revenge on him.
I think when most people think of Motown, they think of it in its heyday, you know, this very glamorous record label. When Mary first signed, what was Motown like in reality?
Well, it was still trying to hold on. I mean, Gordy famously claimed that he started it with $800 that his family gave him. But nevertheless, you know, trying to get a whole music company going, even if your salaries are almost non-existent, it still takes some money. You still have to pay people to record the stuff, the musicians, the background musicians especially. You have to pay the singers to some extent. You got to pay the factory that prints the records or presses the records. So he was always under financial strain, and that was his real problem. And, you know, he'd try to get a hit, and then if it didn't work, that money that he'd spent on that was wasted. So he declared the place Hitsville in order to inspire everyone to get 100% hits so none of the money would be wasted. A hit would help, but it wouldn't rescue them. So that's when Mary came in.
At the height of her career, she was working with Smokey Robinson on the songwriter. He was her songwriter, essentially. And I want to talk a little bit about the song Two Lovers, which is a story song kind of with a twist at the end. And it's a song with a little bit of a devious quality to it, yet Mary kind of sings it with such an innocence. Talk a little bit about why that song was a little risque for the time.
Well, yes, it was. It was both risque and innocent, which gave it its sort of sweet and sour flavor, which appealed to a lot of people because that became a big hit. Oh, everybody liked it. The trick that you're talking about was at the beginning, this was in the early 60s, she seemed to be saying in public that she had two lovers, two physical lovers, That was the implication. Basically the same time, or, you know, one on the night shift and one on the day shift, as people used to say. And that was scandalous. People would, you know, they'd stop in the street. What? This woman's saying she has two lovers? But I've got two lovers and I ain't ashamed. You listen to the whole thing, and then at the end, this is if you hadn't heard it before, of course, at the end, she'd say the two lovers are basically, they're one, they're the different moods and the different sides of her one boyfriend. 'Cause you're a split personality. Before that song, Mary was still singing heavy, kind of blues influenced songs, because that's what black music was at the time. But then around 62, the girl group phenomenon started, where these relatively young singers, mostly in their teenagers basically, would sing innocent kind of lyrics on top of a very heavy instrumental background. That was pioneered by Phil Spector, Spector's Wall of Sound. And, you know, they talk about Leader of the Pack and, you know, My Boyfriend's Back. They were kind of teenage lyrics on top of this big booming sound. And they made singing much more innocent than it had been. And the black and white musicians, seeing how well they did, followed them. And that's where Two Lovers came from. It was a light sound with heavy lyrics, so it got the best of both worlds.
The song that Mary is likely best known for is My Guy. It was Motown Records' first number one hit. Talk about what Mary's fame status was like at that point in her career when that song came out.
That was the top for her whole life, and certainly for her singing career, and it was really the top for Motown. They had not prior to that had a big soloist, either male or female, who made it to the top so many times. I mean, there was Two Lovers, You Beat Me to the Punch, several other songs, all rising very close to the top on both the pop and the R&B charts. And finally, My Guy on, I believe, both charts hit number one. It was fabulous. She was their first anchor person in the old sense. She was holding the whole company together because she was the only soloist on the company that was getting consistent hits. She was it. She was the star of Motown. This was Diana Ross, Flo Ballard, and Mary Wilson were all in the background, and everybody else was trying to keep up with Mary Wells, but they couldn't quite do it.
So she's at the top of her game, but she decides to leave Motown Records. She wants out of her contract. Why?
Well, the real answer is money. It's funny because one of Gordy's first hits that he himself wrote or co-wrote was called Money, That's What I Want. That was the title, and that was the obvious theme of the song. And that encapsulated his business theory and Mary's. Unfortunately, their theories couldn't do the same thing for both of them. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that Motown kept going by paying even its big stars like Mary less than their counterparts who worked for other companies were getting. So, she couldn't help noticing that while she was getting approximately $75,000 a year, which in the early 60s was quite a high salary, I don't want to put it down. It's even pretty good now, I would say. The people on the charts who worked for other companies who weren't as high on the charts as she was were getting something like $250,000 a year. So if you do the math, as they say, you'll find out that she was being cheated out of whatever $75,000 subtracted from $250,000 is every year. And she didn't like it. She really thought, like a lot of people think, that money was the money she received, which showed how much she was worth. When she didn't get it, she figured they were dissing her, basically, which they were financially. So she decided to leave.
And after leaving, she never really had quite the same success that she had at Motown. Was her decision to leave a mistake?
Yes. I mean, we're Monday morning quarterbacking 40 years later or whatever it is. But even she admitted it was a mistake after 10 or 15 years had gone by, and she never got back to where she was in Motown. I don't think she'd realized that she was as assisted as she was by Smokey Robinson's writing. I mean, she had had Holland Dozier Holland and Mickey Stevenson and other writers at Motown working for her. They'd all done fairly well, but she and Smokey had kind of a mind meld. They were just on the same track musically. They were friends. They were only platonic friends, but they knew exactly what they were doing. As soon as Smokey wrote various hits for her, culminating in My Guy, they had the perfect team. So in retrospect, she should have stayed on with Motown and just told Gordy that she was going to leave unless he gave her exactly the same or more than the stars that other record companies were getting.
Just as her career had its ups and downs, so did her personal life in many ways. She was married and divorced a couple times. And beyond those relationship struggles, she also had issues with drugs, illnesses, and suicide attempts. She has such a varied life, and very few people have written about it. Why did you decide that this was a story that needed to be told?
Well, I'm glad you say that very few people have written about it because, and now I'll toot my own horn, no one has ever written about it in book form. This is the first book ever written on Mary Wells, which I found unbelievable when I first realized it. And it shows what great gaps there are in publishing, or what great gaps there are probably in every field if you want to exploit them. People had certainly written about it in magazines, and there'd been TV shows about it, but there was almost nothing done about her personal life, which was perhaps the most interesting part of her life. Maybe not the most interesting, but it was certainly as interesting as her musical career.
She was diagnosed with throat cancer in the 1990, and she eventually died of it in 1992. As part of your research for this book, you found recordings of Mary close to death on her deathbed. I guess as a biographer, what was it like discovering these recordings?
Mary was dead before I even thought of writing her book, her biography. And what I did was find out that a guy who was trying to write her biography before she died had recorded 4 hours of her deathbed testimony, basically her telling the story of her life while she was dying of throat cancer. And he'd recorded the interview and he kept the tapes and was willing to give them to me. I mean, we made a deal, and then I got these tapes, which were virginal in the sense that no one had used them and no one had publicized them. So it was like being at Mary's deathbed and listening to her tell her side of the story. Mary really taught a lot of us, including me, how to go on through life and be really determined about what you want to do. I mean, first you have to be sure what you want to do, but she got over that hurdle early, and then she was really determined about everything else she wanted to do, and even though she made mistakes, she continued on right until the end of her life doing exactly what she wanted.
Well, Peter, it's been a great time speaking with you about this story that hasn't been told thoroughly before.
Well, thanks.
Peter Benjaminson is the author of the book Mary Wells, The Tumultuous Life of Motown's First Superstar. For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.